Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of the book of Genesis. We're in chapter 31. We pick up at verse 21. In fact, we'll back up to verse 20. Jacob deceived Laban the Syrian by not telling him that he was fleeing, that is, fleeing with his family. We're in the midst of that escape narrative. So Jacob fled with all that he had, and he arose. He left Mesopotamia, he crossed the Euphrates River, and he set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. And when it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, then Laban, his father-in-law, took his kinsmen with him, his private army, and he pursued Jacob a distance of 7 days' journey. And Laban overtook Jacob in the hill country of Gilead. At this point, there is a sort of divine intervention. Verse 24, And God came to Laban the Syrian in a dream of the night, and God said to him, Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob either good or bad. And Laban caught up with Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country there, and Laban with his kinsmen camped in the same hill country of Gilead. And then they have a conversation. Mustering all of his relatives like a military force, Laban pursued Jacob like an escaping army. That continued for 7 days. He finally caught up to him in the hill country of Gilead. Gilead's a fertile highlands on the east side of the Jordan River, if you're looking at a map, not terribly far from where Jacob will eventually settle on the western side of the Jordan River. Some of you have probably been over to that country. I don't know how it looked then. But the Bible seems to indicate it was very fertile then. It's very beautiful and fertile-looking now. Well, Jacob and his family and his servants would have been overmatched by the Labanites had their meeting come to hostilities. And that probably would have been the case, for Laban seemed to consider Jacob and his entourage almost like runaway slaves, and he may have had the intention of bringing them back with him. Now, that we do not know for sure. But the text has that air about it, especially when we see God in a dream having to warn Laban against any aggressive or hostile behavior toward Jacob. The expression in verse 24, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad, does appear to forbid Laban to intimidate by hostile actions or to deviously ingratiate himself with Jacob in a covert attempt to lure Jacob and his family back to Paddan Aram, which God himself had told Jacob to leave. In other words, God intervenes. He's telling Laban, this transaction guy is out of your hands. It's in my hands. And Laban is being warned not to meddle or try to make it otherwise or do anything that would excite more stress than is already necessary in their movement back to Canaan. Being warned not to stir up any confusion in the family by deceitful allurements to Laban's children. Well, having met up in the hill country of Gilead, Laban seems, in verses 25 through 26, to rebuke Jacob for his furtive flight from Mesopotamia. He tries to make it sound almost like a kidnapping. You've carried off my daughters like captives in war. Now, let's stop right there because it's a very practical application. We often see it in family relationships. The problem I'm about to point out didn't begin just with Laban. Laban seems to have been one of these people who has a possessive character. He could not get it through his noggin that his daughters were no longer his property. They were full-fledged adults. They were no longer under his authority. They were married. All of that was relinquished when he gave his daughters to Jacob as wives. Now they belonged to Jacob. Jacob could come and go with them just as Jacob pleased. Neither they nor he had any obligation to keep hanging around Laban's family compound forever, as it were. It was this unspoken, at least until now, misperception of their relationship that had allowed Laban to take advantage of family ties for as long as he did. His thought was, "You owe it to me." Very often, folks, though I think it is more often mothers, but not always, parents cannot let go of their adult children. By their interfering or sending not so subtle messages, "Honey, you still belong to us," and by sowing the notion that we still have the right to call the shots or at least be consulted, imprudent parents undermine the natural order. A marriage then becomes dysfunctional, and it might even end up in divorce, and I have seen it. Watch being the Laban parent type. The Laban parent type needs to learn to butt out. And if you're one of those who has a Laban parent type, you need, if necessary, to tell them kindly but firmly, "We love you, we care for you, we'll try to be there for you. But Mom, Dad, your domestic authority is stale-dated. That check can no longer be cashed in our home." When you have a son or daughter and they're 25 years old, they are an adult. Lay off. Get out of the mix. If they invite you into the mix, that's wonderful. Fine. Give them your best advice. Impart your best wisdom. When my wife and I got married, she was 19 and I was 20. Her parents never once, and they were strong parents, ever thought of interfering in our relationship in any way. But certainly, when you get into your mid-20s, I'm just picking a time, you need to get out of their lives as far as trying to run their lives, trying to rule their lives. And I've seen family relationships broken over that very kind of thing. And some of those who have bought into that have been exposed to a lot of this Bill Gothard stuff. I thought most of that passed in the 70s and 80s, but I find it's still around. Dump it. Get rid of it. Wash your consciousness of it. It's bad stuff. Well, verse 27, having been warned of God, Laban now disingenuously tried to put a happy face on his distress. He claimed that he was mostly upset because by leaving so furtively and hastily, Jacob had denied him, Laban, their father and their grandfather, the privilege of giving Jacob's family a celebrative, festive send-off and even a chance to hug the wives and kiss all the babies. Of course, all that protest on Laban's part was a crock of dissimulation. But now that he was there with his armed family forces, at the last minute, divine revelation had interdicted his, we believe, hostile intentions. In the wake of that dream warning, Laban is left to scramble. Now he starts making up dishonest motives for chasing them all the way to the hills of Gilead. And in this, he's a total phony. He can't resist telling Jacob that in absconding with his family, Jacob did a foolish thing. For Laban, he reminds, Jacob had the arm backing. He could have done Jacob harm. Jacob should have been smart enough to have considered the potential consequences. Laban had to get in that dig. He had to do that in order not to look so dumb and foolish by dragging his whole extended clan on this long journey, 7 days from home base, only to make camp together and smoke a peace pipe. That was a sort of face-saving tactic. He explained that this was all that was saving Jacob's hide. "Last night the God of your father told me not to mess with you in any way." Verse 29, "It's in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, and he said, be careful not to speak either good nor bad. Now you have indeed gone away because you long greatly for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?" Verse 30. Okay, Laban goes on, "I get it. You've gone off because you long to return to your father's household. I understand that." Clearly he's in denial. He didn't understand anything. In the first place, the main impulse of Jacob's leaving was not homesickness on the part of Jacob. Rather, Jacob and his wives were fed up to the gills with the crookedness and the cunning of Laban and the hostility of Laban's sons, brothers-in-law. It's a classic instance of people being unable to accept responsibility for the wrong they do and the natural reaction to those wrongs. In that kind of social dynamic, things don't get fixed socially or emotionally. So instead of just asking Jacob to explain himself, Laban puts on this whole scenario, the interpretation he wants, the narrative that he wants. As a result, the family ties will be forever broken. Often happens. But Laban does have one grievance, which he puts forward as the basis for the high moral ground in his family divorce, so to speak. "Why did you steal my gods?" he asked Jacob. We've got to remember that while Laban has some familiarity with the God of Abraham, he is still most likely a polytheist. That act of theft, somebody in Jacob's party did commit, but it wasn't Jacob. In that day and culture, that was a serious, not a trivial matter. So asked for some accounting as to why he and his family took flight as they did, it was quite simple, Jacob answered. "Had you known I was leaving, I just had the fear that you were so possessive of your daughters that you might come and take them away from me by force." He didn't need to add that your pursuing me through hill and valley for an entire week with an armed force has done nothing to dissuade me from my conviction that you would have done exactly that. As for the theft of your idols, verse 32, Jacob says in effect, "I don't have a clue about that. But I will say this, Laban, you don't need a warrant. I authorize you to do a search and a rummage through all of our possessions. Do it right here and do it right now in front of all your extended family as witnesses. And should you find the image in question in the possession of anyone in my party, that person will be considered guilty of capital offense and they will be condemned to death, so go for it." Now right here, we're seeing human interactions, but behind it all is a sovereign God, a gracious and merciful God. So in verse 33, Laban went into Jacob's tent, went into Leah's tent, went into the tent of the two maids, but he did not find the idol. Then he went out of Leah's tent. He entered into Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle, and she sat on them. Laban felt all through the tent, didn't find them. When he came to her out there sitting on the camel, she said cunningly, "The family genes, I remind you. Let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is upon me." So he searched. Laban did not find the household idols. Then, verse 36, Jacob became angry. He was ticked. Now he unloaded. He contended with Laban. He answered and he said to him, "Let's talk." That's not in the text, that's the spirit. "What, sir, is my transgression? What is my sin that you've run me down like an animal, that you've hotly pursued me like an enemy? Though you have felt through all of my goods, invaded my privacy, what have you found in all of my household goods? Set it right here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that they may decide between us two who is righteous and who is unrighteous. 20 years, man, I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten the rams of your flocks. That which was torn of beast I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. You required it of my hand, whether stolen by day or by night. Thus I was. By day the heat consumed me, the frost by night, my sleep fled from my eyes. 20 years I have been in your house. I served you 14 for your 2 daughters, 6 years for your flock, and you change my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, had not been for me, surely now, I just know you would have, you would have sent me away empty-handed. But God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, so he rendered judgment last night." Wow. "As for the theft of your idols," Jacob says, "I don't have a clue about that." So Laban and his party, given permission by Jacob, conducted a thorough search. No luck. Last of all, he entered Rachel's tent. This, except for the gracious, merciful providence of God, could easily have been the end of her. But it so happened that in the providence of God, she had placed her image in her camel saddle and was seated on it. Laban turned the tent upside down. He found Zip. At last, Rachel apologized to her father for her lack of normal courtesy. But she explained, deceitfully, that she could not rise because she was having her menstrual period. Again, in the mercy of God, that passed unchallenged. Now, I should pause right here and mention that the significance of these idols probably had something to do with inheritance, and Rachel was trying to make sure that they got theirs if there was any inheritance left. We don't know about that for sure, but there's evidence for that. Well, verse 36, Jacob was aboil with indignation. He took Laban to task. He had been a pretty cool customer up to this, but it was time to get it off his chest. He had had it with Laban, and Jacob is not going to part from Laban without his father-in-law knowing, to put it mildly, what a jerk he had been for these last 20 years. Now, folks, in my opinion, in situations like this, this is probably a good thing. Nothing good may come from it, understand. On the other hand, nothing good can come from it without citing the offenses which have divided you and another person. These things need to be confronted. So long as the accusations are true and just, so long as we're not out of control, so long as we remain sober and dignified, but keep truthful and straightforward. You see, reconciliation in social relationships may not occur. However, you must do your part to lay the groundwork for that. And Jacob did his part. He cleared the air. It could be days, months, even years after the fact. But Jacob confronts Laban with all the evil that he has done him. There's at least the chance that once all the cards are on the table, guilt, it may have to soak a while, but guilt may finally break down the resistance, and repentance may occur to the glory of God. So Jacob now puts before Laban a bill of particulars. He strips the man of all of his efforts to seize the moral high ground. He strips him of his ability to save face in front of all of his relatives by trying to smear up Jacob. He is a narcissist. The fault always belongs to somebody else. The narcissist is never wrong. The narcissist is always the victim. Laban had made himself the victim. So Jacob pulls off that mask. With people like this, they always want to shift the blame for their embarrassing behaviors and put a good face in front of others. Sometimes they just need to be exposed when a good opportunity presents itself. For Jacob, here is one such window. Now before men and God, Jacob exposes 20 years of Laban's chicanery. His testimony should explain to any reasonable person the grievances that caused Jacob to leave and to leave the way he did. Jacob gave Laban no opportunity to retreat back to his homeland, wearing the status of a victim, wearing the status of a wounded brother, offended by an ungrateful son-in-law. Jacob demands that Laban account for why he ever chose to hunt Jacob down like a thief. Have you found the gods you say were stolen in my possession? Have you found any other goods that belong to you? Well, sir, in front of all these witnesses, mine and yours, put them out here in front of God and everybody. Good move. But that is not all by any stretch. As Jacob continues in prosecutorial mode in this open-air court of contending families, not only has there not been any crime to justify you people from treating me as a fugitive from justice, but now that we're all here together and we have all these witnesses between us, let me set the record straight. 20 years I've worked my backside off for you. During that time your flocks were under my care. Your sheep and goats have not miscarried, nor have I misappropriated your rams to put food on my own table. Challenge me if you can. I've been faithful to my task in your behalf. Not only that, but on those occasions when some wild predator managed to mangle any animals belonging to you, I did not bring them to you, asking you to take the loss. I took the loss myself. But that did not stop you from demanding, he continues to prosecute Laban. Whenever somebody stole animals by night or day, you took account of that, and boy, you always demanded that I compensate you for the loss. In other words, Laban, here before God and everybody here standing, you always played hardball with me. No matter that the heat consumed me by day and the cold by night, hey, I walked around caring for your flocks while sleep fled from my eyes. You had no sympathy. You had no compassion. You cut me no slack. You were never concerned for anything but your bottom line. Jacob is unloading 20 years of grievance, and it's just grievance. Kidner aptly remarks that in his rebuke of Laban, Jacob strips away the romantic image of the work of a shepherd. He exposes its grueling side and its hardships. To that depiction, every would-be pastor should take note. Shepherding work is not typically a romp in the park. I like the expression of the late Jess Moody. Sometimes it's one long, hot ride through Ulcer Gulch. Well, Jacob says to Laban, "Well, that, sir, was my experience with you the whole 20 years I worked for you. 14 of them as a bridal price, 6 to earn my share of the flocks. We had an arrangement. By that arrangement, we would determine which belonged to me and which belonged to you as the flock reproduced. But the minute you didn't like the way things were going with that, there was no negotiation of a new deal. You just jumped in like an autocrat, arbitrarily and high-handedly changed the wage formula every time I turned around. Whether 10 times is a literal figure or just a symbolic figure, doesn't matter. The truth is, Laban, you're a conniver and a shady dealer. Sometimes we just have to confront people. But when we confront them, we need the facts, and it's good to have witnesses. Had it not been that the God of my father, the God of Abraham, was with me, I would have been busted, and you would have sent me packing without a thing to my name. Only by the grace of God, by his divine intervention, last night, in your dream, has that outcome been averted. By your own testimony, God, who knows the truth, who has seen all the hardship you've imposed upon me for these 20 years, and who knows all my hard work in your behalf, God, the God who promised to protect Jacob, the God who is always faithful and always keeps his word, to you, to me, to Jacob, to Abraham, to Isaac, and whoever. He stepped into the gap, and he rebuked your bad intentions." Well, in response to Jacob's scathing indictment, Laban, so often the case, doesn't acknowledge any or all of the wrongdoing that he's been accused of. He'd probably lose too much face in the sight of all the troops that followed him on his godless misadventure. So he pathetically falls back on the "we are all family" excuse for his traipsing all that distance after them. He's still unable to come fully to terms with the fact that he is not the owner of all that Jacob possesses, and he has no legal right to pretend he does. But he's willing, oh, what a big-minded man, as a matter of concession, to agree that possession is 9/10 of the law, so to speak, and conceded that all are in Jacob's possession. So what they do, eventually, is agree to a covenant like one was needed. It's kind of a pretense that Jacob might come back against him hostily at some point. That was not going to happen. That was not in Jacob's mind. In any case, they made a covenant and moved on. One great threat God has caused to pass. It's in the rearview mirror. Another is up ahead in chapter 32. It's Esau. How will Esau respond to Jacob's return after all these years? But now Jacob has great monuments of God's protection, provision, and prosperity. He has come to know that God is faithful as promised. But still, Jacob, folks, is like us. He's flesh. And he has a lot of residual guilt. Like Peter, when walking on the water, took his eyes off Jesus and focused on threatening waves, we too are prone, in this flesh, to doubt. Jacob will wrestle with his fears, fears amplified by guilt. Now awakened by how Laban had so deceitfully treated Jacob, Jacob remembers how he had treated Esau. Profane man or not, Jacob had jerked him around. And Jacob knew, as he prepared to face his brother after a long, long absence in Cana, there could be big trouble up ahead. What would his attitude be? Though if he had full confidence in God's promises, it would seriously have minimized that threat. Well, thank you, friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.